traffickers don't want to target people that folks are going to call the police about. They want to find somebody that, and this sounds terrible, that nobody is looking for, that nobody cares about. There's a term for it, and they call them throwaway kids. You know, like throwaway kids are most likely to be trafficked. I mean, like that's the bottom line. And so it's going to keep happening until we address the vulnerabilities in children in a way that we treat everybody the same, and we are taking care of people that are in the foster system, that are in DFACs.
This is For People with Bishop Rob Wright.
Hi, everyone. This is For People with Bishop Rob Wright. And we have the distinct pleasure today to be with a friend, Jonathan Tong, who is a litigation attorney at Anderson, Tate, and Carr. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Bishop, how are you doing?
I'm great, and I'm glad to get you here. I told you on that evening that we met, I'd get you, and here you are. So glad to have you on the podcast, man.
No, glad to be here. Glad to be here. I pushed back a little bit, but you know, I think it was a nice move to come on. So thanks for having me.
Of course. So Jonathan is a litigation attorney, as I said, at Anderson, Tate, and Carr, and he's graduated from the Georgia School of Law. We might add magna cum laude, and he has done all kinds of wonderful things in the law. But I met Jonathan one evening at St. Luke's Episcopal Church, and we were all there to talk about sexual trafficking, and the evening was specific. It was about having men there at St. Luke's to talk about and to hear from all of these experts on the subject. You know, all the talking heads were there. I was there. Many other people were there, and they had all had great things to say. But towards the end of the program, Jonathan just stood up and told us a story about his work combating sexual trafficking. So before we get to all of that, Jonathan, tell us a little bit about what you do day to day.
So what myself and Pat McDonough, also at Anderson, Tate & Carr, what we do is represent survivors of sex trafficking in civil lawsuits. And so, you know, not on the criminal side, but we typically sue businesses that profited from our clients' trafficking and knew or should have known that was going on. And so that's illegal. You can get sued for that. And so typically that looks like us suing hotels. So we sue a lot of hotels in the Atlanta area. We've done some out of state in South Carolina and other places, but generally, you know, we have a client who is a survivor of sex trafficking, and typically our clients have been in a lot of hotels in Atlanta and a lot of the same hotels in Atlanta where this stuff is fairly endemic. And I think a lot of people associate it with like the airport, and they say this is because of international travel and this, that, and the other. And there is a lot of sex trafficking down at the airport on Old National, particularly, but it's also like I've found in the northern suburbs a lot more than people think. And it is basically like any business, right? And you take the business where the customers are. And there are a lot of people that live in Atlanta who, you know, call it home in Cobb County and Gwinnett County and other places. And they are buying sex, and they're buying sex from adults. Some of them are buying sex from children. And that happens a lot more than you would think. And the places that we tend to target, when I started this, you know, I thought it would be more of a, they sort of missed it, you know, like they were negligent, they turned a blind eye, they should have seen this, but they didn't. And then what we have learned is honestly more typical in our cases is that the hotel absolutely knew, and their employees knew, and at times were involved, and people are being paid. People are having sex with girls at the hotel, trading rooms, that kind of thing. And so it actually is a lot worse than I thought it was when I first got started. And we have been fortunate to kind of get to the other side of a few cases, and we've started settling some cases with some of our clients. And so, you know, it's been kind of a long road for about 3 years, and we've gotten to the place where, you know, we have clients who were 18, 19, 20 years old now. One of them, like, you know, just recently had a baby, and we've, you know, been able to impact her life in a way that, you know, I don't think was possible before, whereas she was living kind of on the margin before. And now, you know, she has a trust set up for her kid, and like she's got a trustee that's taking care of her money, that will set her on a different trajectory. Because like a lot of other things, sex trafficking is tied to poverty in a lot of ways, and it's tied to vulnerable people and things like that. And so it's been a very difficult path to get there, but representing survivors of sex trafficking has been, you know, just a life-changing experience. And I used to think that it was like, you know, that I was doing the hard thing, you know, that I was like carrying these people. And I was like, I'm the one doing this and leading them to this place, but it's not that at all, you know, and that puts me in the center of the story, and that's not what it is. And it's more, you know, that I have the privilege just to walk with people who are doing an incredibly difficult thing. And like the survivors that I work with are extraordinary, and they're brave, and they are getting up and telling their story in a really adversarial system where there are people paid on the other side whose best day at the office is to make my client look like a liar. You know, like that's a really hard place to tell your story, right? It's not in church where people are clapping you and slapping you on the back and stuff. You know, I mean, it's somebody with the same degree I have who's paid to basically make this sound like it didn't happen. And I've seen that over and over again. And it's really just more about, you know, they need help to get through the legal process. And that's what Pat and I do. And we're fortunate to work with those survivors. Well,
let's back up a bit. I mean, you said a tremendous amount. One, you've said, and I know this to be true, that Atlanta and you know, the big five counties that make up Atlanta have the unhappy distinction of sort of, you know, being in leadership in the country in sexual trafficking. Right. And so whether it's the sort of perfect storm of airports and poverty and hotels, et cetera. But that is absolutely true. And that hadn't stopped. And what we find out, too, is that the majority of the customers for this are in our wealthier suburbs. You know, the county where I live, Cobb County, Gwinnett, and others. And we are the ones who are purchasing adults and boys and girls.
Right.
If I got that right?
Yes, that's completely right. And the boy, yeah. The boy side is unfortunately kind of a lesser told story. And I think that it's smaller in number, but it's not like an insignificant number. And I think one of the reasons it is lesser told is there are fewer services directed towards those boys. And so there are not enough, but a handful of like group homes for survivors of sex trafficking in Georgia, but they're all for women, you know, and they don't intermix. And I believe the closest home for boys would be in North Carolina. And so you don't get the same wraparound services if you're a boy, unfortunately. Right. And so I think some of those stories do get minimized, but it absolutely
there's not nearly
happens.
Enough beds. I mean, you know, when we just look at supply and demand, there's not nearly enough service providers to work with these folks who are trying to come out of this life.
Right. And I mean, because they have to segregate it. And so they have to have, you know, like a home for minors, you know, and then they'll have a home for adults and stuff like that. And so, I mean, there's probably less than 100 in the state, you know, and there's just, I mean, like last night, I read a news article about this big sting that rescued like 25 minors in Georgia, you know, and that happened. That was just yesterday, you know. And so it goes on to an alarming degree. And I think people that I've read stuff where people tend to minimize the problem, and the statistics are hard to come by, but it's a bigger problem than most people think. There are a lot more people. And the reason is that there's a lot of vulnerable people, and that has to do with poverty. It's not necessarily, you'll see things on the internet like, don't park between two white vans or else they're going to do whatever. Like, that's not really how it happens at all. And what traffickers do and are good at is recognizing a vulnerability in a person and then exploiting that to the biggest degree. So if there's a group of, say, teenage girls there, then the skill that they actually have is figuring out which one, you know, comes from a broken home, has a drug problem, is in desperate need of attention or affection, and then they give them whatever it is to exploit that vulnerability. And so it absolutely can and has happened to anybody and all sorts of people, but there are risk factors that make people more likely. And probably the greatest one for a minor would be people that run away. And so, yeah. You know, if you're from a broken home, you're in the system, you're in defects, you're in a group home or something like that, and you either ran away from your home to begin with, or you're in the group home and you run away from that. I mean, those are people you know, traffickers don't want to target people that folks are going to call the police about and call the news and say, oh, my God, my daughter was on the cheerleading squad and now she's gone. And, you know, they want to find somebody that, and this sounds terrible, that nobody is looking for, that nobody cares about. And there's, you know, there's a term for it, and it's, they call them throwaway kids. You know, like throwaway kids are most likely to be trafficked. I mean, like, that's the bottom line. And so it's going to keep happening until we address the vulnerabilities in children in a way that we treat everybody the same, and we are taking care of people that are in the foster system, that are in the DFACs.
Throwaway kids.
It's a terrible word.
Wow. But,
yeah, that wow. is what they say. It's particularly like it happens to a lot younger. Like, I've got clients who were 12, 13, 14 when this stuff started. And but particularly you get to like 16 and 17 and you're no longer mandatory to go to school. Right. And so it's not like there's a teacher that say, hey, where's so and so? They just assume they dropped out. And then all of a sudden you're just, nobody's looking for you. You know, you're just out there. Yeah.
And just for the record, these are white kids. These are black kids. These are Hispanic kids. Is that right?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we represent more people, just of our clients, which is a smaller sample size, but we represent mostly people who grew up in and around Atlanta. Like, they may have come in from somewhere, but they're typically local. And I mean, they grew up somewhere around here, or they have family somewhere around here. And yes, white, black, Hispanic, we represent people who fit all of those. And we do, you know, middle class or, and below. I don't know that we've represented anybody who's, you know, super high, you know, income earner, but it could happen. And the way with the, in the middle class thing, what I see more often is it's somebody with a drug problem. And so they, you know, and they're typically, their family also has people who have drug problems, and that's what gets exploited. That's the vulnerability. And it's somebody whose family has gotten to the point where, you know, it's like a tough love thing. And they're like, well, she's gone and she's doing her drugs and we're not worried about her right now.
Right.
And then what's actually happening is, you know, somebody's using those drugs to control her and get what they want.
So what you have said so far is we're talking about very vulnerable kids, right? We're talking about kids nobody's looking for. We're talking about skilled predators. Right. And then now we're talking also about a system which is in, you know, more or less collusion with all of that. Right. You know, hotels, other businesses looking away or actually even, you know, actively participating to make all this happen.
Yeah, it takes, you know, to be perverse about it, it takes a village. Right. And you need a lot of things to traffic people or to have that thriving model. And you need victims, you need people that you're selling, you need buyers, you know, but you also, if you don't have, it's a little weird to say on a podcast with a bishop, but like, if you don't have a room that is fairly anonymous and able for a lot of different guys to come into and have sex, then you don't have sex trafficking, right? Like, you got to have a physical, you got to have the infrastructure also. And that's what hotels, some apartments, massage parlors have provided for a long time. And I think for a long time, it didn't have the focus and attention, you know, that it does now. And I think that started changing in the early 2000s when they passed the Trafficking Victim Protection Act and other laws nationally. But, you know, it was just sort of, this is what, you know, if you own a low end economy hotel, it was like, that's what happens. And that's what people do. And we've had people testify in cases who work at hotels, and you know, it's like working in a war zone, you know, where you're like, your sense of normal gets perverted to the point that you're like, oh, well, when I go to work, what happens is like, I put the Bloods over here in this building. I put the Crips over here because they don't want to mix. I put the Gangsters, Disciples over here, and everybody's got girls that they're selling, and then the buyer traffic. And it's like you say, I mean, if you're in a low end economy hotel, like, your parking lot shouldn't be full of like Porsches and Lamborghinis and like, you know, right. BMWs and things right. for 20 minutes and then gone, you know, and like this rotating thing. But that's what happens, you know, like those kind of cars shouldn't be in those parking lots, you know?
Right. Well, let's back up a little bit. You told me a little bit about what you do, and you sort of described the landscape, and I wanted to get you on for a couple of reasons, but just to let people know, I mean, you know, what we're talking about is, we're not bashing the Georgia, we're not bashing Metro Atlanta, but you know, Jesus was always interested in who his neighbor was, and he was asked about who his neighbor and all that. And so in the Diocese of Atlanta, we're 75.5 counties. The centerpiece of that, of course, is the Metro Atlanta counties. And so what we're really talking about is we're talking about our neighbors here. you know, on every side of that equation. We're talking about our neighbors. And so how'd you get into this? So, I mean, walk me through this. I mean, I've got lawyers in the family, and lawyers, you know, sometimes lawyers get a real bad rep. You know, they're sort of out here, you know, squeezing money and all this sort of stuff. How did you get to this sort of benevolent neighbor work? What's going on with you?
I'll tell you, let me do a quick aside and then I'll tell you that. But just related to the neighbor thing made me think of this, and it's related to that. But I remember reading that with Ed Bacon. We had a book study at St. Luke's a few years ago, and The Universal Christ by Richard Rohr. I don't know if you've read that. And that was a very pivotal kind of moment and book for me. It was when I was struggling with a lot of things about whether I would do this work. But I remember right at the beginning, he's talking about the lady that, like, and I forget, she's famous too, I think, and I don't know her name, but who comes off the train in England, you know, and she says she saw Christ in everybody, in everybody's face, and that kind of thing. And she says something like, the everything without exception is an outpouring of God, you know? And so, and that's something, and I was like, yes, that's absolutely right. This is wonderful, you know? And then at some point, my son, who was probably 7 or 8 at the time, was asking me, like, what do you do for a job? You know, and it was kind of complicated to talk about, you know, and what I said was something like, you know, well, I represent clients who were sort of kidnapped by bad people, you know, and bad things happened. And then he, like, corrected me. And he said, well, they're not bad people. They did bad things. Right. And that's because that's something that we had talked about and like that I taught him. And then it was really hard for me to think about that and to say, without exception, everything is an outpouring of God. Because if you think you like that has to include sex traffickers, right? Like it has to include sex traffickers if it's without exception. And then, you know, I wrestled for kind of a long time with whether I actually believed that or whether that was some crap I told my kid, you know, and I wanted to believe that. But the stories, you know, that I have heard are horrific. I mean, it's terrible, terrible things that have like some of the worst stuff you could imagine. But it was kind of that part in the book and talking to Ed about, you know, even in like the barren emptiness, right? Like that's where resurrection happens. And if you believe in resurrection, then like that is the ground for resurrection. It's like ultimate suffering is what pushes through to that. And so I still think I believe that without exception, but it is a difficult thing to enact day to day, you know?
Hi, listeners. Thank you for listening to Four People, a space of digital evangelism. We encourage you to keep up with us on Instagram and Facebook at Bishop Rob Wright. And now back to Four People.
It gets tried, doesn't it? I mean, I think that's the journey so many people are on. You know, the little, on the way to hear a little bit more about your biography, the little snippet that helps me immensely is Jim Forbes used to be the senior pastor up at Riverside Church in New York. And Jim Forbes said that God doesn't cause everything, but God can use everything. And so that helps me to remember that God has given us all grace, mercy, and strength, and we can choose to use that however we want to use it. But ultimately, God can bring redemption out of any low, low ground. And so that is what's redeeming. But I love the fact that your kid.
Oh, he put me on the spot,
he
man.
Put you on your spot.
I mean, I like, it was something, man. But to jump back, so the way that I got into this is, I mean, it was absolutely a calling. And like, I've never really thought about a calling. And Horace Griffin at St. Luke's kind of helped me put words around
Shout
it.
Shout out to St. Luke's Episcopal Church.
No, no, it's a bunch that happened over there, man. And so I went to law school kind of late, like in my mid-30s. Like I had a lot of messing around. This law is probably my 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th career at this point. But and so I was kind of older, and you know, I didn't have a plan for what I wanted to do when I went in. One of the things you do in law school are these kind of big like research article things that you try to get published, right? Like in the journals and stuff, the academic journals. So what I was researching happened to be the Trafficking Victim Protection Act, which is like the law that I use every day now. And at the time, I was trying to do something, and it outlaws labor and sex trafficking and allows people to sue for that. And at the time, I was trying to figure out something about labor trafficking, and it just felt like it was a square peg in a round hole, and it wasn't working. And I was honestly, I didn't really know what I was. In your second year of law school, you don't really know anything anyway. And so it was not working, and it was really frustrating, and I kind of threw up my hands about it. And I remember like being in the library at Georgia and saying, well, this is stupid. And like, this whole idea I had is dumb. And like, this is not going to work. And I'm like looking at what the law says. And I was like, I mean, what this really makes sense for is that sex trafficking victims should sue hotels. I was like, it's obvious that that's what should happen. And then I started looking around and like, nobody did that. Like nobody, and the law had been around since 2008. This is 2014 or 15 when I'm looking at this. And there was like one case in the Northeast. Some wonderful lawyers in Massachusetts were doing that case, and that was it. I mean, that was the whole landscape, right? And so it was like seeing some big like thing that I thought of as a solution to a big problem, and everybody like walking by and ignoring it, you know. And I just, that really bothered me, and I was pretty frustrated about it, and so. Honestly, just like got obsessed with that idea. And like, that was like, for the rest of law school, that's all I talked about. And I would read an article about a sex trafficking victim, and I'd be like, this person should sue a hotel. That person should sue, you know. I was like, well, look at this. This happened here. Excuse me. And so that became like what I wanted to do. Like, and I have no experience in this. I have no background working with trauma victims, nothing like that. I ended up taking a great clinic at Georgia, the CEASE clinic that talks about trauma-informed lawyering, that was very pivotal. But I get out and I end up going to work for Anderson, Tate & Carr. And I went there because I thought that it was the kind of firm that would get behind this and support it, you know, even though it sounded at the time like a frankly kind of crazy idea that nobody else is doing. And I was ended up being right about that. But like, there was some wilderness time there too, where I ended up leaving the firm because some opportunities come up. I go to clerk for a judge, which is kind of like, you know, it's like a big deal that people want to do. So I did that, and I end up at a different firm after that, mainly because I thought at this other place that it would be more likely to happen. It was taking too long, right? And so I was thinking like, it's going to happen faster at this other place. And so I kind of abandoned Anderson Tate. And Anderson is where I met Pat. Like he's a partner over there. And, you know, he's like a brother to me now. I mean, like I talked to Pat more than I talked to anybody. But we had stayed in touch that whole time. And we talked endlessly about how you could do these cases, how this is going to work. I mean, he got us as into it or more than I did, you know, and he believed in it 100%, and he was willing to do it whether I was there or not. Like, we could do it together at different places, and like, you know, that would work out. And a lot of things happened, but 2 years later, at the end of this, I sort of was presented with this choice where I could stay at the job that I had, which was a really good job and like at a great firm and doing well and that kind of thing, doing interesting work, but not doing the sex trafficking work. Or Pat, you know, made it possible for me to come back to Anderson and we were going to go all in and start suing hotels for sex trafficking victims, start doing it. And in hindsight, I mean, that's like obvious, like this is what I do now. So obviously that was the right decision. But at the time it was really, I was sort of torn up about it. You know, it was kind of anguished. I had at that point, if I had changed jobs then, like I would have had like four jobs in 4 years. Like my wife is starting to wonder, like, you know, is this guy ever going to keep a job? Like what is happening? You know, and sure. got a young kid and stuff. And this is how it made me think of Richard Rohr. And so I go to one of those book studies on Wednesday night at St. Luke's, and it's a Richard Rohr thing. And I happened to, you know, traffic in Atlanta is unpredictable, but it happened to work out in a good way. And I got there like super early, like 45 minutes before the thing started. And so I went into the nave, and my dad's an Episcopal priest. And so I spent a lot of my life at the church, you know, like after school every day, you know, like we'd be up at the church with my siblings. And I love to be in the nave by myself, like to be in a church by myself. It's like the most quiet, like magical kind of place around, you know? And so I was agonizing about like whether I was really going to toss it all and go full bore on this thing that I'd been talking about for years. And if that was the right thing for my family, if that's what I should be doing now, a lot of doubt and second thoughts. And, So I sit down in the church and I start praying about it. And so I'm kind of praying for guidance and that, you know, whatever decision I need to make, that I'll know which one that is and that it's right and that I'm doing it for the right reasons. And I did that for a long time. And then there was like this, and it is true, man. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but it's true. And then there was this like loud snapping sound, like a creaking noise, right? Like it's an old building. And so like, it's like the building settling, and it was kind of, it was so quiet in there that it was sort of like jarring, you know, and it sort of snapped me out of the prayer. And I was kind of dazed, and I sit back and I'm like, man, that was weird. And then the Book of Common Prayer is like right in front of me in the pew, you know? And so I pick up the Book of Common Prayer and I just open it, you know, just flip it open how you do sometimes with the Bible, you know, sure. like you just see like, all right, what you got for me? and it opened to Psalm 91, the Key Habitat Psalm. And I don't know if everybody knows that, but, and I had read it, I think, but I don't think I had paid attention to it, you know? And, I started reading that, and I mean, I felt crazy. Like, I mean, it was like whole electric, like more alive feeling than I've ever felt in my life. And it said basically exactly what I needed to hear at that point in time. And I read it maybe twice then. And after doing that, I just had no doubt about what I needed to do and what I had to do. And that was what, you know, that was what happened. And, you know, a couple of months after that, I was back working for Pat, and we filed the first cases in Georgia, you know. But that's what happened. I mean, I didn't go to law school thinking I was going to sue hotels for sex trafficking victims, but, and I wasn't really, you know, qualified to do that. But I had no doubt that that's what I had to be doing, you know.
Well, you know, there are such, I just got to highlight this because there's such key elements in your story that are sort of true for so many people who are sort of leaning and lurching forward, trying to do the right thing in the world, trying to honor their commitments to faith, trying to keep a roof over their head, trying to make sure that their spouse knows that they're reliable and not crazy, and all of that. I mean, you talked about discernment. You talked about a cost to that thing. You talked about feeling unprepared. You talked about, you know, having to deal with, you know, being questioned. You talked about all of that sort of stuff. And what's funny is that if you go to Psalm 91, it says in one version, it says, "Whoever dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty." And then it goes on to say, "I will say to the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust." And then the third verse, "Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare." And so what's interesting to me about that is that not only do you feel guided, supported, encouraged to take up this ministry that had some sort of a burning annoyance in your life, but now you're saving people from the fowler's snare. So it's funny how God is always playing chess on two and three boards same time, right? I mean, he's saving the saver who will save this, you know, those being saved, right? And all of that, while I think God, while God is smirking at us saying, you know, "I'm God and you're not, just strapping for the ride, you know, I'll take you on a wonderful ride." Well, as we wrap up, I mean, you're so good to tell us all of this, and I just appreciate it. You're blowing a lot of people's mind about what lawyer is, and thank God we're just blowing those stereotypes out of the water. But, you know, what you also just did, and I just got to thank you so much, is that, you know, you're sometimes the church, you talked about your clients trying to tell their truth, their story in a hostile environment. And sometimes the church can be a hostile environment to tell our God story. Sometimes it's not the most warm and accepting place to talk about how these words we say on Sunday are alive and dancing in my heart, in my imagination. I don't always have it figured out, but I'm trying to live in the tension of quote unquote the real world and my Sunday world. I'm trying to make my Monday look like my Sunday. And so I want to thank you for saying all that, because some people, especially in the Episcopal Church, I think it's okay to say, especially in the Episcopal Church, where we have such credentials, you know, we have such learning, we're so well-traveled, we're upper crust and all of that, at least that's the stereotype. Sometimes we struggle to get down to talk about, hey, this God is alive and well in my life and causing me to do things that doesn't necessarily make sense, you know, by some measurement. And so is Dad still an Episcopal priest? Is Dad still working?
He retired, and he was in Waycross for 22 years maybe, and he retired up here to be closer to grandchildren, and he was still doing supply mainly in Toccoa. Until recently, I think maybe at some point in COVID, he stopped doing that, but yeah, he would probably still do a supply gig here and there if he needed to. But yeah, my dad gave the greatest sermons in the world. And I remember being in the back of the church, you know, and like, as I got older, you know, and, you know, it took me, you know, about a decade longer to grow up than some people do. But, as I got older, I was like a backbencher myself, you know, and, with a bunch of these other guys and women and stuff. And we'd talk after church, and I would always say, like, you know, that sermon was about this thing that I did that he's upset about. And I was right. Like, that was directed right at me. And then you talk to somebody else and they're like, oh, no, that was about me, man. Like, he was talking, and like, my dad had that skill where it was like, it was applicable to everybody. And what he was before was an eye doctor, and probably the great example, that I think about all the time and kind of helped me with this is that he had four young kids like in the early 80s. So me and three siblings, like under, I don't know, six or seven or something. And he quit being an eye doctor to become a priest, you know? And so like that also is like a decision that doesn't make any sense economically for your family or whatever. And that maybe is not the lesson that he wishes I would have drawn from that. But like, you know, what I drew from that is, you, when you got to do it, you got to do it, you know? And I mean, there's not a choice. And so that was always a powerful example that he set for me.
Amazing. So I want to correct you as we go. You said he preached some wonderful sermons, some great sermons. I'm looking at you and hearing something about your life. I'm thinking that you are one of his greatest sermons.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know about that, but yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah. I learned a lot from him, and, I always enjoyed hearing his sermons.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, what is that thing, you know, preach the gospel. And if you have to, you know, use words. And so I want to thank you for preaching the gospel of good news, and that in God's economy, there are no throwaways.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. That is one of the tragic terms. And I would just, you know, before we get off, I would encourage, there's so many great organizations in Atlanta that you could work with. And please. I mean, they're like Street Grace, Out of Darkness, For Sarah, Rescuing Hope, like Youth Spark, you know, Beloved Atlanta. There's all these places that, you know, need money, need volunteers, need people to help. And working with sex trafficking survivors has been like a profoundly life-changing event for me. And you will just never... You're never prepared to hear somebody tell you, like, you're like, for me, like, you're the first man that ever like stuck up for me and stayed around. And like, I've been working with some of my clients for like 4 years now, who didn't abandon me, who wasn't trying to use me, who was not trying to twist what I did. And, I had one tell me the other day who said that, you know, that I was the first person that ever told her that what happened to her was not her fault, you know, like just like, some, this happened to you, like you didn't cause this, you didn't deserve this, you know, but the shame and sort of embarrassment about it, it's hard to get over, you know, and sometimes you just got to directly tell people, like, this is not you, you know, like this happened to you, but this does not define you, and you're not to blame for this. And that's, it's a wonderful message to provide. And there's a lot of ways that people could get involved and do that work also.
Yeah. That's what we need. We need an army of faithful lawyers.
Yeah,
to help us with these broken systems and our participation in them. So, friends, we're on with Jonathan Tong, and he is an attorney and here in Atlanta, and he is sticking up for those who others want to throw away. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
No, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, God bless, man.